So glad you're here.
Having a good day? Yes, good. We didn't expect to have a full house this afternoon like we did this morning. We thought maybe it'd be smaller, but we are so happy to see you.
We are blessed.
Thank you for coming.
We just wanted to welcome you to Mad About Marriage and talk to you a little bit about what is going to be taking place here. Actually, we want you to first of all meet our family. We thought we would start off with that, let you know we actually have a family. We raise kids. Right down here at the bottom is Michael Ann. She is our youngest daughter. She taught school for a year, went back and got a master's degree in counseling, just like her dad. And now she has worked for the Dallas Independent School District as a counselor. She's worked as a counselor for a battered woman's shelter. And now she's also opening up a private practice. And so that's Michael Ann. And right above her is her husband, Levi. And Levi's been a part of our family now for about 7 years. And Levi is a teacher at Dallas Christian Academy. And we could not be happier to have Levi and our family. He is a delight.
And just above Levi is Allison. She is our older daughter. Allison is also a teacher and currently is serving as the principal of Dallas Christian Academy. And if you just noticed that Levi is working at Dallas Christian Academy, so we have brother-in-law, sister-in-law working together there. She's his boss. So
I wonder how that's working out for him.
That's interesting. But it's going well. Most of her career before she became principal, she was teaching 7th and 8th grade. And people would say, oh my goodness, 7th and 8th graders, how do you stand that? She said, you know what, somebody's got to love them and it might as well be me. So that's her approach to teaching. And then we have one more little sweetheart. This is Anna. She is our one and only granddaughter. She's about 18 months old now and we're just having so much fun with her. And she's got a huge spark of life.
She sure does. We got another one on the way right now, and that'll be here in December. But, you know, for years I saw grandfathers come out with all these pictures and photographs talking about their grandkids, and I thought, well, that's a little over the top. Now I'm the president of the Dallas chapter of the Over the Top Club. And so if you need to see photos and videos, I've got them on my computer or my phone, you name it, and I can talk ad nauseum about my granddaughter. And so it's just a lot of fun. You know, the new one's on the way. We don't know if this is a girl or a boy yet. We'll find out later. But our plan is, whether it's a girl or a boy, we're going to love it and spoil it just as badly as we can, along with this one. So it's just a lot of fun.
Well, we want to tell you a little bit about what to expect from this seminar, because it may be a little bit different than some that you've been to.
Yeah, this is not marriage counseling, and you're not going to be asked to divulge your deepest, darkest secrets in front of this group. Isn't that nice to know? No one will have to be talking here. If you're here with your spouse, you'll be given an opportunity to chat at times with your spouse for a brief time, but you're not going to share your dark secrets with anybody here. This is marriage education, and we're going to share principles that help relationships. And so it is marriage education and not marriage counseling.
We're going to take time to look at some of the good things. What are the good things that we can do in our marriages that will help us? And then we're also going to look at some of the red flags. Because, you know, there are negative things in our marriages at times that we need to address. And sometimes they come to us because they're things we brought with us from our past. Sometimes it's just the circumstances of life. But if we don't take a look at those, they can be damaging to us. So we're going to look at some of those things as well. If this is like every other group we've ever been with, there are people who are here that are excited about it. They're thinking, this is great. You know, we'll take some time and look at our marriage and see where we are. And they're excited about being here. But there are also those who have been dragged here.
Your heel marks are still in the parking lot.
Yeah, that's right. Your spouse said, yes, you are coming.
And you're going to enjoy it.
And if you find yourself as that person that really doesn't want to be here, you're not alone. There are other people that feel the same way. But what we'd like to ask of you is the fact, you know, since you're here already, why don't you just take this time to have an open mind and an open heart and ask the Lord if there's maybe one kernel of truth that He has for you that He could that he could teach you this week that you could apply in your marriage. So just have an open heart and an open mind.
Well, people have asked us why Mad About Marriage seminars. I mean, after all, we make television programs. Well, our flagship show is called A Lifestyle Magazine, and it is a felt need program. We look at what people need, and we provide programs in those areas. And one of the areas of need across the world, really, but certainly North America, is for marriage, because marriages are falling apart at an alarming rate. So we wanted to do something that would help. And so we came up with the idea of having a series of programs, and it became so successful we've stripped it out now as its own television program, and we added a seminar to go along with that. And we've entitled it Mad About Marriage. And we simply ask, are you madly in love, or are you just plain mad? And you know, we get a variety of responses to that. This morning you may be madly in love, and by this afternoon you want to strangle each other. Well, welcome to life. That's how the world works, isn't it? I posted this title on my Facebook page and asked my 5,000 very close friends there what they thought about the title. And I immediately got one response that said, mad about marriage. Well, if you mean madly in love, then yes, because I'm madly in love with my husband. I thought, well, that's cool. The next response was, mad about marriage? You bet I'm mad. She's just left me and she's filing for divorce. I'm mad as hops. And the third response was, mad about marriage? I'm glad there's finally a seminar for this. I've been trying to figure out who talked me into this mess. But our goal here is to provide keys that can help you flip the switch from just plain mad to madly in love.
Marriage is one of those things about which everyone seems to have an opinion. And we found a few opinions that we thought we'd share with you that were kind of fun. This comes from Don Harold, and he said, marriage is a mistake of youth which we should all make.
Wow. That was lovely.
I have no idea what just happened. We'll pray that it doesn't happen again.
Okay. Did you get your afternoon nap earlier?
Yeah, you're awake now.
I'm gonna wake you up.
Richard Steele said the marriage state with I think we found the culprit here. With or without the marriage state, with or without the affection suitable to it, is the completest image of heaven and hell we are capable of receiving in this life. Heaven and hell, really? All right, let's go to what Abraham Lincoln says. And that is?
He says, marriage is neither heaven nor hell, it is simply purgatory. And there are those who would agree with him and those who would not.
Go ahead.
Okay. Your story.
Okay. Thank you. We'll get this worked out eventually. I promise. We'll figure out what's going on with that crazy thing. I used to work as a hospice chaplain. And hospice, as you know, is an organization dedicated to caring for those who were terminally ill. And there was one couple that came on our program, a woman who was dying, and of course her husband with her. She was dying of cancer. And they had been married for 67 years. They'd been high school sweethearts. And in high school, he knew he wanted to marry her, but he wasn't going to ask her until he was ready. And that meant that he finished college, he got a graduate degree, he got a job and saved money, and then asked her to be his wife. And they got married when he was 27. So you do the math, he was now 94. And she was not far behind him. She was not afraid of dying. But she did not want to die alone. She was frightened of dying alone. And so when the hospice nurses thought, you know, tonight may be the night, they called in the family. She was having some pain they couldn't control, and so they brought in a hospital bed, thinking it might make her feel more comfortable. The problem was this. In 67 years of marriage, this couple had never spent a night apart. For 67 years, they had always slept in the same bed. Always. 67 years. And so she went to bed, and she was in the hospital bed, and one of the sons took the first watch, and the husband, Roy, went to bed. But you know, after 67 years of sleeping in the same bed with that woman, he couldn't sleep, could he? He was tossing and turning, and so he just missed Ruby. And so he got out of bed and put on his trousers and got his walker and walked into where his son was with his wife in the hospital bed and said, "You go on to bed. I can't sleep anyway. I'll sit here." So he sat there and turned on the TV and kind of looked at the channels for a while, and then he said, you know, I felt impressed to turn the TV off. So he did. grabbed his walker and walked over to where her bed was, and he reached down over the railing and took her hand and squeezed it. She opened her eyes, she smiled, she closed her eyes, and she died. Just like that. When I talked to Roy about it later, he said, "You know, I feel so guilty." I said, "Guilty? I understand hurt and loss and pain, but guilt, tell me about that. Why do you feel guilty about this?" He said, "After 67 years, there should have been something more. I should have done something. I should have said something rather than just stand there like a dummy." I said, "Well, perhaps that's one way of looking at it. But maybe there's another way of looking at it. 67 years ago when you got married, where were you?" "We were in Cleburne, Texas." "Whereabouts?" "We were in a church." "What were you doing?" "Standing in front of a preacher." "What else were you doing?" "We were holding hands." I said, "You were what?" "We were holding hands." 67 years later, when she died, what were you doing? "Holding hands." I said, "Roy, Ruby came into this, left this marriage the same way she came into it, holding your hand. Do you think for one moment she would have had it any other way?" He said, "I guess not." Through the weeks as I visited with him, I began to ask him questions to help him process his grief. And one day I asked him, "Do you have any regrets?" He said, "Yeah, I do have one regret." 67 years of marriage, one regret. That's not bad, right? "All right." I said, "All right, Roy, what's your regret?" He said, "I always thought we would have more time." 67 years, nearly the last 30 of which he's been retired. They've spent almost 24/7 together. They've never spent a night apart. And the one thing he wanted for that marriage was more time with Ruby. That's the marriage I want. How about you?
You know, that's the marriage that God has in mind for us. He wants us to have the intimacy of sharing the journey. You know, we can share the births, the deaths, the in-laws, the moves, the jobs, everything else that goes with life, and have someone to share it with. A journey of intimacy.
That's right.
What he has in mind for us.
It is.
Now, as we start this seminar, one thing that we need to be aware of is that we need to have goodwill toward our marriages. And we want to show you a little video that speaks about that.
"You know, we do marriage seminars frequently, and just about every week someone comes up to us and says, 'You know, I love all the principles that you present. I love the things, the tips on marriage, but, you know, it's really not going to work for us because my spouse just doesn't care to make any changes.'"
And the truth is that all the marriage advice in the world and all the marriage tips in the world will not help you unless there is an assumption of goodwill by both parties towards the marriage and towards each other.
An assumption of goodwill says, "I will never intentionally hurt you." It says, "I want the best for our marriage. I'm willing to make changes to accommodate you."
That's right. It says, "I'm committed to you. I'm committed to this relationship. And I don't want to do anything that's going to hurt the relationship. We're going to make this work." That has to be the basic assumption in order to make any marriage tip work.
So, the best thing you can do for your marriage is have goodwill toward it to begin with.
With that in mind, we'd like to share a couple of exercises with you.
What we'd like for you to do right now is just take a couple of moments and pray silently, individually, asking the Lord about your openness to your marriage and your commitment to it, and asking Him what it is that He might have for you to learn this week, whether you've been married, you know, 6 months or you've been married 60 years. There are things that we can learn. So we want to take just a moment of quiet prayer and individually, and then Mike will kind of lead us out of that.
All right, let's pray. Amen. Next take a moment together, if you're here with your spouse, to ask yourself the question, do we possess an assumption of goodwill toward the relationship and toward each other? Do we both assume that our partner has the best interest of the marriage in mind and my best interest in mind as well? Talk about that with each other for just a moment, and then we'll start our next presentation.
To give you a little taste of kind of starting a conversation together. And we want to go on to the next presentation. It's called Danger Signs, so you should have received a handout there for danger signs. And these handouts, you're welcome to use them to take notes on, or just to read along if you'd like, or as Mike usually says, use them as paper airplanes if you want to.
Yeah,
whatever you
it's
want
your call.
If you have one you don't need, there may be someone else that might need it. How are we on those? Okay, we have no more. So if there's anyone that didn't get one, and anyone that has one they don't need, we might pass it around.
You got an extra one right here? Okay. Ishmael, we got extra here.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you.
We're starting out with, there's one right there and over here.
So we got some extras around. That's good. We can get everybody covered then.
Good deal. Danger signs, what are we talking about? Well, we're actually going to start out by talking about something negative. I mentioned that sometimes there are negative issues that we have. And sometimes people say, well, why would we talk about the negative? Why don't we come and just learn good principles that we can add that will impact our marriages? Well, here's why. The University of Denver did a study a number of years ago. And they decided that they would do a long-term study. The professors in this study were Stanley and Markman from the University of Denver. Their premise was this: if we could study marriages over a long period of time, then perhaps we could find the principles that make marriage work. And we could take those principles, begin to teach them, and have a positive impact upon the dismal divorce rate that we have in North America. Seems like a good premise, right? So they did the study. They studied marriages for more than 20 years. When they came to the end of the study, what they found was that marriages that succeeded looked very different. They seemed to succeed for all different reasons. And so they couldn't come out of the study saying, all right, if you will do A, B, and C, you'll have a successful marriage that'll last forever. But what they did find surprised them, because they found that marriages that failed had some very strong common denominators. And in virtually every marriage that failed, there were at least one of these patterns of communication that were present. There were four negative communication patterns that they identified. And every marriage that failed had at least one, and usually more than one, of these communication patterns. They found these to be the strongest predictors for divorce and failed marriage that they could find in the study.
That's right.
The other thing that they discovered is that these patterns of communication were passed on to the children in these homes, and they tended to take them on into their own relationships. So what basically that was saying is that if we have negative communication patterns in our marriages, we pass them to our children, we can actually predispose them to failed marriage. Now, I think that makes it worth looking at, don't you? When I lost my train of thought. The other thing that they discovered.
Well.
What you usually talk about.
Okay, let's go on from there. They found that eliminating one of these negative communication patterns does more to ensure the long-term success and stability of your marriage than adding five positives. Removing one negative is more powerful than adding five positives. That's incredible, isn't it? That one negative out of this is more powerful for the long-term stability and success of your marriage. In fact, if you don't remove the negative, the positive somewhat seems somewhat disingenuous very often. Why is that?
Well, it's because we are sending a mixed message. You know, if Mike sends me flowers, but at the same time, he on a regular basis is criticizing me or calling me names or yelling at me, wouldn't I just rather he not do that? The flowers don't mean much, do they? So adding positive things when there is an underlying negativity in the way we communicate on a day-to-day basis is not meaningful. It's not helpful.
No. So removing that is going to make then the positive seem positive rather than disingenuous.
And when we talk about failed marriages, we're talking about marriages that either end in divorce or marriages where you don't divorce, but you just live kind of a parallel life under the same roof, and there's no intimacy and no real closeness. And so that's what we're talking about when we say a failed marriage.
So would you like to know what these four negative communication patterns are? Well, good, because if you didn't want to know that, we've got nothing else to say today. So we're glad you're going to do that. And by the way, one of the neat things about this is this. In your marriage, there are several things that impact the potential for failure or success. Some of those items are static items, the things you can't change, things you don't have any control over. Like if your parents got divorced, it predisposes you to divorce. Well, you didn't have anything to do with that, and it's not something you can change. You can be aware of it, try to counteract it, but you can't change that. But then there are dynamic factors, and these are the factors that you can actually change. And the most powerful influences over whether or not you succeed or fail in your marriage are dynamic factors, not static factors. And all four of these negative communication patterns are, in fact, dynamic factors.
And that's really great news. It means that we can change these things and they don't have to impact us in this way.
The first of these negative communication patterns is called escalation. Escalation occurs when an argument starts, usually over something small, and someone says something negative. The other person, not to be outdone, comes back with something even more negative, upping the ante just a bit, right? Well, again, I started this so I can't be outdone, so I come back with more negative, and we just keep going back and forth, upping the ante. It increases in negativity. At times, it increases in volume as well, until it reaches this Mount Vesuvius eruption. And my leaving socks on the floor can end up with I'm leaving you, and you're wondering, how did I get from point A to point B? How did this happen? It doesn't make any sense. And yet it happens with great regularity in some marriages. We've created a little video that we think helps illustrate this pattern of communication. So watch it and see whether or not you've got this.
Hi. You put the dishes in the sink again.
Oh, yeah, I was in a hurry.
You're always in a hurry.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, I've asked you, like 100 times. All you have to do is take the plate and rinse it and then set it on the counter. I mean, heaven forbid you put it in the dishwasher, but you keep filling up the sink.
Yeah, well, it's a better place to put the dishes than just leave them on the floor where the kids left them. You know, if it's such a big issue for you, how about just move it? You know, the sink is made to be used.
That's the point. You keep stacking them, and I can't use it.
Well, so you're going to start using the sink? Oh, that's a refreshing idea.
I'll tell you something that would be refreshing. It would be refreshing if I could actually believe what you said. I asked you to do this one thing with the sink, but you keep filling it up. It's like talking to a wall.
You know, can't you just give it a break? I mean, all you do is nag. You know, when I cook a dish, I love just once in a while to hear, hey, thank you, honey. But I never get that from you. All I get is this. All I get is your nagging.
You are unbelievable. You pick up one dish and you want a standing ovation? Jerk.
What, I'm a jerk? Why is that? Because I don't buy into your little OCD where you have to stack the plates just perfectly or you have to fold the towels right? You know, I've had it.
Just stop it. I go to work all day and then I come back here and I work all night. You can't even lift a finger. It's completely unfair, and I don't need this.
You don't need this? I don't need this. Now you know why I put up with this.
Nobody's begging me to stay.
sink will be happy together.
Painful to watch, isn't it? All right, we're not going to ask for a show of hands of how many have ever done this. That's good news too, isn't it? But I will say this. If we get through all four of these negative communication patterns and there's anyone here who has never done any of them, I don't like you. Because this happens. You know, this is life. And most everyone goes through at least some of this at some point in their lives. People do this.
And we don't want you to beat yourself up over it.
Because no.
These are kind of the natural reactions, the things that come out naturally. And what we need to learn is how to change that.
That's
so
right.
That our natural reaction is a different one.
Let's take a look at some of the damage that is done by this particular pattern. First of all, it inflicts deep and lasting wounds. They have wounded one another, and that's not going to be done away with easily. And it sends hurtful messages that you may not even really mean. In fact, some people say, hey, you must really mean that because you said it when you were very emotional. Well, the research shows that people say things they don't mean when they're emotional, and chances are they didn't mean it. However, whether they meant it or not is not the issue, because it has left a wound. Even if you don't mean it, if you say it, it still hurts like crazy, and it still leaves the wound.
The other thing that happens is that it shuts down true communication. You know, there's usually an underlying issue when you get into an argument over something like dishes in the sink or socks on the floor. It's not really about that. It's about something else, but you never get to that. So you leave the real problem unresolved because there's this explosion, or this at least an escalation of the negativity in the way you speak mm-hmm. to one another, and you never get to that. So the real problems stay unresolved, and it destroys the feeling of closeness and the feeling of intimacy. They're not feeling real warm and fuzzy toward each other.
No.
Are they? No, and that's what happens. The more we attack one another, the less we feel close to one another.
All right, but let's fix it. It's one thing to know what the problem is. Let's fix it. And the first thing to do is to acknowledge that you do it. Discuss your patterns of communication. Acknowledge whether or not you do this. If indeed you do it, you can't fix it unless you acknowledge it. You can't fix a problem that you don't admit that you have. But if together you say, you know what, we tend to do this, maybe not every day, but you know, this tends to be our pattern, that's step number one in fixing it. Acknowledge that you do it. And then realize that successful couples will find a way to exit the pattern during the first 1 to 3 minutes of the argument. You'll find it early. The earlier you find the pattern and exit it, the better you will be. So they find the pattern coming on early and they find a way to exit.
But that's easy to say and hard to do, right? Because if you start getting into an argument and it starts getting more heated and you're more emotional, how do you just suddenly stop that? Well, one thing that we recommend is to develop a cue. And that means that in a calmer moment, when you're talking about your relationship, and hopefully this can serve as that time,
right,
that you acknowledge that you do this and you say, all right, let's have a cue, something that will help us to stop. So the cue can be anything that you choose. Maybe it's something as simple as a phrase.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like,
we're doing it.
All right, so if that's our cue, we're doing it. Then if we start getting into an argument, it starts to get heated, and Mike says,
we're doing it.
Then I'm going to stop. He's going to stop. But does that fix everything? No. In fact, it's probably going to make me more mad, isn't it? Because I'm already upset, and he's calling me out over this marriage thing we went to, and I don't like that at all. And so I'm probably going to be more mad, but I also know that this is not a pattern that I want in our relationship. I've already decided that ahead of time, and so has Mike. So when we hear the cue, we have made this agreement, we're just going to stop at that point. You table the issue, you walk away from it. You may even walk away from each other for a little while in order to cool off. And then you need to come back to it at another time when you can discuss it in a constructive way. And that may be where the issue lies, that we don't always have a constructive way to discuss it. So that's one thing that we're going to talk about in tomorrow's seminar, is some problem-solving skills that you can use. So you would leave it alone, table it, walk away from it. A little bit later, you come back and say, all right, when will be a good time for us to talk about this?
Right.
And you actually set a time.
Usually within the next 24 to 48 hours.
That's right. Doesn't mean you come right back and talk about it. You set an appointment to talk about mm-hmm. it. And then come back with some good problem-solving skills.
And then you determine that you're going to deal with issues, but you're also going to do so in such a way that you protect your spouse from attacks. You're going to make your spouse feel safe. We all need to have a place of safety.
When we say protect from attacks, that means, you know, it may from be protecting him from me. Or he
from
may,
me.
You
yeah.
may be protecting them from yourself.
Right.
And you're going to make that commitment.
All right, that's the first negative pattern of communication.
All right.
What's the second one?
Number two is called invalidation. Invalidation is a pattern where one partner either subtly or directly puts the other person down. They put down their thoughts, their character, their feelings. This is a tough one. And the reason it's so tough is because it has a wide range of ways that we invalidate. It can be very direct. It can be very intentional. It can be very subtle or unintentional. So that makes it kind of difficult, doesn't it? Sometimes it's direct. We know we're invalidating our spouse. We're calling them names. Mm-hmm. And when it goes to name calling, what's wrong with you? You're a jerk. You heard that in the video.
You're such a loser.
You are. Do you never learn?
Yeah.
Things or, like that.
Or how about this? You're just like your mom.
Or you're just like your father.
Yeah.
Those can be fighting words, can't they? So we sometimes we're very direct with our invalidation, and we know we're doing it. Other times we're more subtle with it. You can invalidate a person in a subtle way, especially over a long period of time, by condescending attitudes. Don't worry about it. You wouldn't understand. I'll take care of this. That's kind of bad, isn't
it?
But that is a pattern that you see often in abusive relationships, where you just send this message: you are less than. You don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't measure up.
Mm-hmm.
It can be intentional, it can be unintentional. And when we are unintentionally doing it, that's one of the things that we really need to look at.
Right.
Am I invalidating my spouse without even realizing I'm doing it? So that's what makes it difficult. There are a lot of ways we can do it. Let's look at one video that shows a fairly direct kind of invalidation.
I'm really sorry, but I got a ticket on the way home.
You got another ticket?
Yeah, you know, I didn't think it was...
You got another ticket.
Yeah. I didn't think I was speeding.
With the amount of money that we're paying in fines, we could have practically had a new car by now.
I know. You know, I've been slowing down, you know that. So, I just thought I was going to speed limit.
Right. People that don't speed don't get tickets.
She's just saying, you're just too stupid to live. I don't believe you. You knew you were speeding. And, you know, you are messing up our family by doing this. And you can almost see her finger waving in his face, can't you? And you notice his reaction?
He's just shrinking.
He's shrinking. Well, I've been slowing down.
Yeah.
He sounds like a little boy, and she sounds like a scolding parent, right? Is that ever an appropriate kind of communication between spouses? Never.
No.
It should always be adult to adult, and it should be peer to peer, and that's not what's happening there.
That's right. We need to show our spouse the respect of having adult to adult conversation. If we over lecture, over instruct, if we talk down to or scold or blame, that's entering into a pattern of behavior we call parent-child communication. And that is always demeaning and always destructive of the relationship. But to be adult to adult is what we need, and that is pure respect for one another.
So there are a lot of ways. One way to invalidate is to ignore the other person.
Yeah.
And when you ignore them, this says you are not even worth acknowledging that you exist. And that is very demeaning. Another way is by interrupting.
Yeah.
Let's say we go out to eat.
Okay.
We go out to eat with another couple. And we're there for a nice evening, and I start to tell the story. So you know what? Last week we went.
It was Tuesday. Tuesday, yeah.
Last Tuesday. Last Tuesday we went to the mall.
It's the Parks Mall. That new mall? The Parks Mall is where we went, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, park, yeah. Tuesday at the Parks.
Yeah.
And when we got there, we went around and we parked in that new underground park.
It's over there by Macy's. Yeah, it's a good place to park. It gets you out of the Texas sun. Hello.
Yeah. Okay, we were at Macy's. And we got out of the car, and as we're walking in, there was this guy.
Oh, he was 7'2" if he was an inch. He weighed 450 pounds. And the guy came right up to us. He was like,
And so she just quits, right? Because obviously, he knows more, he can tell it better, you always get it wrong, all of these things. And so, you know, if you notice that going on, where one person just shrinks away and the other person takes over, might be worth taking a look at. Another thing is criticizing. Criticizing invalidates the other person, especially in a situation where they expected praise. There was a couple in our church back in Texas. She was living in Texas. He was living in Florida at the time, and they were engaged to be married. He was there because of work. She was going to take a trip and go see him, and they were both very excited about it. And so he started getting ready for her to come. Now, the one thing he knew about her is that she wanted everything to be perfectly clean, perfectly in its place. She was kind of a neat freak. And he was the exact opposite.
He was a slob.
He had this bachelor place, and it was a disaster all the time, and he didn't care. But when she was coming, he cared. And so he began to clean and to straighten up, and he worked for 2 weeks.
It took 2 weeks.
He worked for 2 weeks to get everything just right, and he was so excited because he had it all clean for her. So he picked her up at the airport on the day that she arrived. They drove to the apartment. They got up the steps, walked in, opened the door. She took one step inside and she said, "Nice apartment, but you never could keep bookcases straight, could you?" 2 weeks' work, and she found the one thing that she could nitpick about. And often we do that. You know, and it may be that we actually like what happened, but the thing that we mention is the one negative. So criticism, especially when praise was expected, is a very difficult thing. Nagging is another way to invalidate. Nagging is huge. Nagging becomes that drip, drip, drip that Solomon talks about. It never stops. And what does it do? Drives you crazy, right? It invalidates the other person. It says, you can't possibly get this done unless I tell you 15 times to do it. It's an invalidating thing. And I'll tell you what, besides, you know, Solomon talks about the drip, drip, drip of a woman. Yeah. You know what? There's also the drip, drip, drip of a man.
I think it's just women that do that.
Men do it too. And that we want to show you another pattern of invalidation, or another example of invalidation. And this one is a little more subtle. Maybe he even thinks he's helping.
So, I went to Weight Watchers today.
How'd it go?
Not good. I didn't lose any weight.
Well, what are you going to do?
I've been trying so hard, and I'm listening and doing everything they told me to do. I'm counting my calories, I'm weighing my food, I'm even exercising, and nothing is working.
Well, it's not the end of the world.
Okay, but nothing is working, and I'm trying so hard. I'm getting frustrated and discouraged.
I really would worry about it. You know, I really don't like seeing women anyway.
What?
He was trying to help.
Ladies, was that helpful? No, not so much. You know, she comes to him expecting empathy, expecting some concern, some support. And what she gets is either he just doesn't get it, or he doesn't care, or he's sending another kind of subtle message that says, just don't talk to me about this anymore, I've heard it enough times.
You know what he's doing. The problem is that he's using guy talk. Because if a guy comes to you with a problem, guys tend to minimize other guys' problems. That's no big deal, buddy. Get over it. Listen, I wish all my problems were that small. And you kind of make the other guy feel better by doing that. Gentlemen, you do that to your wife and she wants to rip your face off. You have to become bilingual. Understand that what works for your buddy will not work for her. And what she wanted was empathy, not to minimize and dismiss the problem, but empathy.
And that's usually what we need, is to be able to understand what the other person is feeling and thinking and be aware of that. There's a lot of damage that is done with invalidation, so let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, it does convey a lack of respect. You need to be fixed, or you're not up to par. It just sends that constant, consistent, persistent message. I don't respect you. And, you know, if you send that message long enough, then eventually your spouse will hear the message and will begin to feel worse about themselves. And it tears down their own self-esteem. Because if the person who's most significant to you in the world believes this is true, then it must be true, and you begin to feel worse about yourself. And it also makes you unsafe for your spouse. You're not a safe person for them to be around anymore, because the attacks come, subtle or direct, and they make you feel less of a person because of that.
It also sends messages that we've kind of alluded to that we really don't want to send. I don't care how you feel. I'm too busy for you. You don't measure up. I have to parent you. I have to fix you. All of those things are messages that we don't want to be sending, and yet it's so easy for us to send them, mm-hmm. especially if we're just not paying attention. So what is our solution?
Well, the solution to invalidation is quite simply validation. You validate your spouse rather than invalidate. You look for ways to turn it around to be a positive that builds them up rather than something that subtly or directly tears them down. One of the best ways to validate is simply to take the time to listen to the words that your spouse is saying, and not just to the words, but to the emotions behind the words. Listen intuitively. Listen for the deep messages that are coming from your spouse. And nothing is any more validating than someone to empathize with you and to listen to your message. Treat your spouse with respect. Adult to adult, treat them with respect.
Another thing is to value them, to realize the value of this individual. They are a child of God, and they are a gift to you from God. And sometimes we forget that. You know, if we can ask the Lord to help us to see our spouses through His eyes, wouldn't that make a difference? When God looks at your spouse, who does He see? He sees a valued, wonderful treasure that He has made. And we usually have recognized that when we stood at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
We stood there and we knew that this person was a gift, and that they were valued, and we valued them in the same way. But sometimes life kind of gets in the way and we forget that as we go along. So to value that person the way God does, and to choose to be their protector, to be their safe place. Now, everyone needs a safe place in the world, don't they? When you think about safety and you look out in the world, you're not going to find it there. You're not going to find emotional safety, maybe not physical safety, and you're not going to find it at work, usually, sometimes maybe. You may not find it in your extended family. Sadly, we don't always even find it at church. But when you walk through your own door into your home, that ought to be a safe place. And that happens when we make the choice to make it safe for one another. That you are respected, you are valued. I'm glad that you are here, and I realize that God has given you to me as a gift.
All right, that's invalidation. Let's go now to the next negative pattern of communication, and that is entitled negative interpretations. Negative interpretations occurs when one party says something and the other party interprets what was said more negatively than that which was intended. Now, in order for this to happen, there has to be a great deal of mind reading going on. It says, all right, I know you said this, but what you really meant was... And, you know, if much of that's going on in the relationship at all, it is really very, very destructive. And the truth is that you cannot read your spouse's mind. You can't read my mind, Gail.
Well, but we've been married a long time. I think I can.
No. You can't read my mind.
You know, we do think that, don't we? And there are certain patterns that we read about the other person, and it makes us think, well, I know exactly what they're thinking. But the truth is, we do not know what another human being is thinking and the deep emotions behind their thoughts, their actions. We need to recognize that.
Well, let's take a look at a video that illustrates this negative pattern of communication.
Hey, babe.
Yeah?
Thanksgiving's coming real soon.
I know. I'm so excited. Everybody's coming over to our house.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be awesome. You know, I know that all the cooking that you're going to be doing, I thought, maybe I could help you.
You. Mm-hmm. You're
going to
help me with
the
cooking?
Yeah, you know, I know it's a lot of work, but, you know, I thought maybe I could make the canned hams this year.
Oh.
You're going to give them a break.
Honey, that's sweet. But, you know what, I make it every year with the dinner, and, you know what, it's no big deal.
Yeah, but, you know, if I could help you, why not?
You don't like my candy jams.
No, seriously, that's not it. I just really wanted to help you with dinner.
Hmm.
That's very interesting.
Honey, I love your candied yams.
You know, I'd rather you just admit that you don't like them.
He is so dead. This guy's wasted. This, he's in trouble, isn't he? I mean, basically, here's the damage. He is trapped. He can't get out of this. It doesn't matter what he says now. She's got her mind made up. She'll twist whatever he says to fit her original premise, and that is, you're just trying to get out of eating my candied yams. That's in her mind now, and she's turned it. It doesn't really matter what he says anymore. And it again, it involves this a tremendous amount of negative mind reading. That's not what he said, but that's what she has read into his statements, thinking, I know better what it is you're trying to say than what it is what you think I do, and this is what it really is. Also, it passes an unfair judgment on him. It says, you are so devious and so sneaky that you won't be man enough just to say, I don't really like the way you make candy jams. Instead, you're going to try to be the hero. You appear to be the hero who's going to help me with dinner when, in fact, all you're trying to do is to get out of eating my candy jams. Now, that's the unfair judgment that she's placing against him and that she's passing on him, and that's just not right.
Another part of the damage is that it kills the desire to communicate. Now, you think about it. If you know someone who, every time you talk to them, it seems like your words get twisted and they come back to you in some other way, what do?
I am not talking again.
You stop talking to them, don't you? You're just not going to communicate because it's not worth it. Because anything you say is going to be misinterpreted. And so that's what happens in a marriage. People just stop talking. There's no communication. The other thing is that it can actually elicit the very negative behavior that you accuse the person of, even if that was not their original intent.
If I'm going to get accused of it, I might as well do it.
And you know, that's a childish reaction, and yet it's what happens. Well, if you're going to accuse me, just watch this.
Yeah.
You know, and we tend to start doing those very things because we were accused of it. So what are we going to do about
Let's fix this thing, all right? Now, here's the news. The truth is that the only person who can really fix this is the person who does the interpreting. The negative interpreter has to change how they interpret things. They have to choose to take their spouse's words at face value, assume honesty from their spouse, assume that they're not going to lie to you.
Now, what makes that work? What makes that work is when you create a foundation of honesty within your marriage.
Mm-hmm.
That you deal with each other in an honest way on a regular basis. That, and when that happens, if I know that Mike is honest with me on a day-to-day basis, and that's the foundation of our relationship, then if he says something that I think is a little bit strange, a little bit off, then I can go back to the fact that, you know what, I know he is honest with me. Therefore, I'm going to choose to take his words at face value.
That's
right. I'm going to believe what he just said. And so honesty comes when you both make that commitment to honesty.
That's right. Also, if you must mind read, choose to do so positively. Ask yourself, is there more than one way to read this? And if you will always choose the positive way, you will never hurt your marriage. If you choose the negative way, you can hurt that marriage. But if you always choose the positive alternative when it comes to reading what's being said, you never hurt your marriage.
Assume the best about your spouse. So you ask the question, is there another way to interpret this? Is there a positive way to interpret it, and put the positive spin on it?
Now, here's the truth. The fact is that early in our marriage, I did some of this negative interpretation. I remember once when Gail did something that hurt me, and I told her about it. And she apologized. I told her about it again. And she apologized again. I told her about it again. You get the picture? About the fourth time through, she stopped me. She said, you act as though I did this on purpose. Now, you got to understand where we grew up. You remember that old 50s sitcom, Father Knows Best, the idyllic home, and where dad was the fount of all knowledge and all wisdom, and the children and mom adored him, and they all went to him, and he solved all their problems in 30 minutes or less, because that's how long the show was. Dad was the fount of all knowledge. That's where she lived. That's where she grew up, only hers was better because they had God. That was her life. I, on the other hand, grew up in The Simpsons. Yeah, we put the fun back in dysfunctional. No, that was us. And in my home of origin, someone might have done something just to hurt me. And so when Gail said, "You act as though I did this on purpose," my initial response was, "Hello, of course." Then she said to me something which became so significant to me that we decided to make it the mantra for our marriage. Here it is. What she said was, "I will never intentionally hurt you." That was a brand new thought to me. She said, "I will hurt you because I'll go brain dead, I'll do something dumb, I'll forget about it, but I promise that I will never hurt you on purpose. It will never be intentional. And if I've hurt you, just stop me, ask a question about it, or tell me that it's hurt, I will apologize. You can bank on this, it will never be intentional." And that takes the pressure off of me. I don't have to mind read negatively or positively, I just ask a question. "All right, that didn't feel exactly right. Could you tell me what's going on here?" And then she can talk to me about it. And you know, we've been married over 36 years. She was 12 when I married her. About 36 years, and in those years, I don't believe she has ever intentionally hurt me. Never once. And so we've made that our mantra. We do our best not to hurt each other on purpose.
You know, if you've been together any length of time, you know the buttons that you can push that really just get to the other person, don't you? The little thing you can say that has this barb in it, and it kind of makes you to maybe win the argument, but you have what you would call plausible deniability. It's like, "Oh no, honey, that's not what I meant." But you know in your heart that's exactly what you meant. And it's so easy for us to do that, but with this mantra, that's what we're talking about. When those opportunities come that you could say that thing that has the barb in it that's hurtful, you're going to pass that up. You're not going to do that. By God's grace, you're going to make another decision. Because when we intentionally hurt, that's very different than when we unintentionally hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Intentional hurt says, "I don't have your best interest at heart.
Right.
I don't love you the way God loves you." So we're going to pass up those times when we know that we could hurt and yet we don't.
That's right. You know, that's three out of the four negative communication patterns. I think we've done enough now, don't
There's
you?
One more.
I don't want to do this one. Let's just not do this, all right?
Yeah, well, we're going to do
I may have to leave if you do this.
Sorry. You're here and we're doing it. This one is called avoidance and withdrawal, and he wants to get out of here. And that's easy for us to want to do, isn't it? Avoidance and withdrawal is a pattern where one partner fails to deal with difficult issues in the marriage, either by avoiding them altogether or withdrawing from the conversation. Now, the withdrawer is the person that when a difficult issue comes up, something they don't want to talk about, it's too emotional, it's too heated, they leave the room. They'll just, "No, I'm not talking about this." They'll just walk out. Or they'll clam up and just get silent and you can't get a word out of them. Another way to withdraw, and we don't usually think of it as withdrawing, is by an explosion of anger. Because if I explode, I have effectively cut off the conversation, haven't I? Even though it's a little different than walking out of the room. So withdrawing is the person that just won't talk about it. Avoidance is a little bit different. This is the person that's very adept. It's like they have a sixth sense. And they know that something may be up. You know, I think my spouse might be a little bit unhappy. They may want to talk about this situation. And so they just make themselves scarce. Maybe they stay late at work so that they don't give an opportunity for the conversation to even start. Or maybe they, you know, they have to do something with the kids or whatever it is. They just are not there. This is a very damaging pattern.
In this pattern, though, let's look at a video that will illustrate this pattern for us. We'll do that first.
Oh, what a day. I'm so happy to be home.
I'm glad you're home, too.
Oh.
I've been waiting up for you. I've been waiting up to talk.
Hmm?
You told Joey that he could build a ramp for his bike so he can do tricks?
Please, please, not now.
If not now, when? It's always not now with you.
Listen, okay? Look, I still have a lot on my plate.
You've always got a lot on your plate. We need to discuss this. We need to work this out. We need to talk about it.
Now, do you always want to start a fight? Like, can't you just choose to be happy?
I'm not trying to start a fight. I want us to talk. I want us to solve this as a team.
Yeah, well, you always say you don't want to start a fight, but we always end up fighting. You know, I don't have the strength right now. You know, Joey's going to be fine.
This isn't about Joey. This is about us. We can't solve anything if we don't talk.
I can't do it right now. I gotta go to bed. We got a big meeting tomorrow.
Don't walk away from me.
Good night.
This couple's a wreck, aren't they?
So what's the damage here? First of all, it leaves the problems unresolved. As we said, there's usually something underlying, there's some kind of problem. But if we don't, I mean, even if it's small, maybe it's just a little thing. But if we don't ever talk about that little thing and fix it, we just kind of lay it there between us. And then there's some other little thing that comes along and we lay it there between us too. And something else, and it builds and builds, and pretty soon we've built a wall between us, and it will separate us. Whether it separates us in terms of divorce or legal separation, or just, as we talked about before, living the parallel lives under the same roof, no closeness, no intimacy. So it results in our separation.
Yeah.
When we do that. Now there are two roles that are being
two played. Roles. The first role is that of the pursuer. This is the person who wants to talk about it. And they want to talk about it because they're seeking intimacy. They think, you know, if we can just talk about this, if we can just talk about it, we can get rid of it and then the wall will be gone and we'll feel closer together. The other role is, of course, the role of the withdrawer. And they're seeking peace. Now, as we think about this pattern, I'm going to ask for a little self-disclosure. How many of you in here tend to be more pursuers? Can I see your hand? You tend to be the pursuer. You want to talk about it? Let's just talk about it so we can feel close. How many of you tend to be avoiders or withdrawers? Can I see your hand? All right. You know, it's really not fair when the spouse pushes up the avoider or withdrawer's hand. It's just wrong. And it really is quite obvious that is true, though. One more question, and that is, how many of you can go either way depending on the topic of conversation? I can either pursue or I can avoid or withdraw. Okay. How many of you don't know what you are? Because a lot of hands didn't go up. All right.
That's right. We have a timid group here.
Yeah, very timid.
So what is the solution? Well, if you find that you are the pursuer, one of the things that you can do is commit to pursue more gently. Don't blindside the other person. One thing that makes a person withdraw, or a withdrawer, one thing that they dread, let's put it that
yeah.
way, is to be blindsided by an issue. You notice he came home late from work in the video, and he was tired, and boom, there she is. We're going to talk, and we're going to talk.
I've been waiting up for you.
Yeah. And did you see his reaction?
Oh, no.
So that's one thing that is difficult for a withdrawer, is to be blindsided. I tend to be more of the withdrawer, even though usually women are the pursuers.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah.
All right.
There are times when I withdraw, and for me, it's I just get really quiet.
The lips get very thin.
But there's the reason for that, one reason for that, is that there's one thing I know about Mike Tucker. I know that Mike has like 500 words on the tip of his tongue for every one I have. And I know that he's got 20 reasons why he's right and I'm wrong before I can come up with one. And I don't like that. You know, so if we get into an argument or any kind of discussion, then it can be, you know, he just kind of cuts me up and I'm down on the floor in a heap and I don't know what happened.
I must be right.
Why
I don't know. I'm thinking,
I don't
hello.
Think so. But if I have time to consider the issue,
then I'm in trouble. Because I may be quick, but she is thorough, let me tell you. She is thorough. And so if she's got time to think about it, I can be in trouble when it comes time to sit down and have the discussion.
So blindsiding is a difficult thing because the person, the withdrawing person, feels like they never know at what moment the hammer is going to come down.
Right.
We're going to have to launch into something negative. So if you are a pursuer, one thing you can do is pursue more gently. You can also ask for a certain time to talk about an issue. Mm-hmm. Say, you know what, honey? We need to talk about this ramp for Joey. When would be a good time to talk about that?
Right.
That gives the person time to consider it. They know what the conversation is going to be. If you're a withdrawer, you need to also make a commitment. And your commitment is, yes, I will discuss important issues in our marriage. I'll do it in small doses, in other words, one topic at a time, but I will do it. And when you have that commitment going with each other, then it makes both people happy, because the pursuer knows, okay, we are going to talk about this, so we'll be able to fix it and we'll be able to feel close again. And the withdrawer knows, okay, I'm not going to just be attacked at any moment, and I'll have time to think about issues, and we can have some actual cogent discussions.
That's right. So we set aside that time for problem solving. We set an appointment, usually within 24 to 48 hours, and between now and the appointment is a conflict-free zone. We're not going to talk about the issues. We're not going to talk about the problems that we have. It's going to be conflict-free until it's time for our appointment, and that's when we talk about things. But we do so having learned the skills to make this time productive. And again, those are skills we're going to teach you tomorrow. We will teach you a method for problem solving tomorrow.
All right. So that covers all four negative communication patterns. We want to take just a moment here. We won't have a long time, but maybe a few minutes.
Yeah.
Oh, let's talk about the scriptural foundation. I always forget that. But this is one of the most important things. Proverbs 12 says, "Reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing."
Beautiful.
And I mean, we could read that over and over every single day. Wouldn't that make a difference for us? Reckless words, the words that just come out naturally, that come out as a defense mechanism, are the ones that damage us.
And again, we don't have a lot of time for this, but we want to give you some time, if you're here with your spouse, to discuss. Do you engage in any of these negative patterns of communication? Talk about your patterns of communication. Do you tend to engage in any of the four negative patterns of communication? And if so, which ones? And then, as you've done that, commit to work as a team on removing these patterns from your relationship. Take just a few minutes, and then we'll come back with our final presentation.
And we don't want you to beat yourself up over these things. We had one couple that said, we did this presentation on a Friday night. They came back the next day on Sabbath, and they said, "We fought about that all night." And we're like, no, that's not the idea here.
Yeah.
Just realize that these are natural reactions, things that happen in pretty much every relationship, and we need to identify them. So take time for these exercises.
Presentation.
Yeah.
At least it has been for me.
Yeah. Maybe we need tomorrow afternoon to see how. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Our brain.
Yeah.
Tomorrow afternoon, maybe we can start with something a little more to get them rolling. Because they don't have any energy.
No. Sure, what you got?
So what's the vernacular for filthy rags, and what was the other one?
Oh.
Filthy rags. guest and you're done with like, I don't know, bullshit.
Yep, that's it. You got it.
Good guess.
All right. I know you have not had time to discuss every communication.
Oh, these guys are sharp. They've got it all fixed now. They don't do this anymore. This is all done now, I'm sure.
All right. They're good to go, right?
That's right.
Okay. Well, we want to move on. We do hope, though, that you'll take some more time and just talk about these things and begin to make this a priority in your marriage. I think it's one of the most beneficial things, the most important things that we teach, one of the most important principles that we have found is those communication patterns.
It really is.
We want to move on to one other thing.
But, you know, even then, just acknowledging that you do it is key. I remember we did the seminar at one town, and after we did the seminar, the church secretary that was sponsoring it, she agreed to ship the materials to the next location for us. And so after she shipped them on Monday, she sent us an email telling us that the materials have been shipped. And then she included a personal note. She said, we enjoyed the seminar. However, Sunday morning after the seminar, my husband and I got into a fight, big surprise. And in the middle of it, he pointed at me and said, that's escalation. It really ticked me off, but he was right. At least now we know what to call it.
Maybe that's helpful, huh? We're supposed to end, they tell us, by about 5:15, so we have one other thing we want to share with you quickly before we're done. And this is called connection.
So, gentlemen, you come home from work one day and your precious, your sweet, your lovely bride is there waiting for you, and she says those dreaded words. Honey, we need to talk. What's going on inside of you when she says those words? Well, according to psychologists Love and Stosny, a lot is going on inside of you, and it has to do with the conflict between fear and shame. Fear and shame. So something's happened in the relationship. Maybe things just aren't as they should be, or maybe something specific happened, and you know it's built a wall between you, and for some reason she wants to talk. Why does she want to talk?
Because she's feeling fear. You see, she has an underlying core belief that says if we're married, we should feel close. And if something has happened between us, I don't feel close. And so she's feeling fear that maybe this will always be this way. There's this anxiety that says maybe we'll never be close. And so she figures if we can just talk about it, then we can get rid of this thing that's separating us and we will feel close again. Makes sense, right? But he doesn't want to talk about it. Why not?
Because actually he accepts more responsibility for this relationship than what you think he does. He believes deep down inside that it's his responsibility to make you happy. And if you're not happy, he senses that he has failed you in some way. And he really thinks that if you really have to sit down and you talk to each other about this issue, it's going to be nothing more than a long litany of the ways in which he has failed you. And that produces a tremendous amount of shame on his part because he senses that he has failed the relationship and failed to make you happy. So it makes him feel shame. And his shame is so intense and so huge, he cannot see your fear.
And her fear is so great that she cannot see his shame. Now, this plays itself out in other scenarios other than the honey, we need to talk.
Yeah.
It plays itself out on a day-to-day basis in our relationships and things that just happen as we go along. For instance, let's say that a couple is going to take a drive somewhere.
Right.
And the kids are in the back seat.
Yeah.
And he's driving.
Of course I'm driving. I'm the man.
Okay. So let's see that.
And I have to get on this side because we're not in England. Okay.
All right.
Here we go. We're driving.
And as they're driving, she's watching, making sure that everything is all right. She's watching the road out in front. She's watching the side. She takes a look at the speedometer, checking that out. She notices that he is very distracted there, that he's often looking at other things other than the road. And she can see that he is looking the other way when a car starts to pull in right here and almost hits him. And she goes,
What?
Involuntary response, right? She's scared.
What are you frightened about? What happened?
Well, you know what? You could slow down a little bit. It wouldn't hurt.
I'm not going too fast. I'm just keeping with the flow of traffic here. Just the flow of traffic is what this is. No, I am not. I'm doing just fine. I've been passed. We're doing okay.
You don't have to pass everybody on the road.
I'm not passing everybody on the road.
Just, you know, watching the road would be helpful.
I have better peripheral vision than you have. I've got everything under control here. I can see everything I need to have. Yeah, I got great peripheral vision. The kids are fine.
Careful.
They thought it was fun. They're having
be
fun.
Careful.
They're having a blast. They're laughing right now.
And on it goes, right? Have you ever been there? Yeah. You have. You do the same thing.
We put cameras in your car, yeah.
And it goes on. But those are the things that happen, you know, with fear and shame. She's afraid. He's feeling shame. He doesn't want her to make comments because, after all, he wouldn't be measuring up then.
Right? That's right. Basically, you're saying that my driving really stinks and that I'm a failure as a driver, and protecting you, I can't do that either.
In reality, she's focusing on the fact that she truly is fearful. She has fear, but he can't recognize it.
No.
There's a quote here, and I believe it's in your notes. It comes from the book called How to Improve Your Marriage Without Talking About It. This book was written by Patricia Love and Stephen Stosny. It says, your relationship can fail with neither of you doing anything wrong if you do not understand the extent to which fear and shame drive your disconnection from each other. This is a huge dynamic in our marriages. And in this book, they talk about how to improve your marriage without talking about it. In other words, not without talking to each other, but without talking about the relationship. You see, sometimes that's difficult for us. And as we talked about in the last presentation, sometimes our communication patterns aren't what they should be, and we don't quite know how to talk to each other. So their solution is, don't talk, connect. The premise being, if we can feel connected to each other, that can open the door for us to be able to talk about some of the difficult issues. So we thought it would be fun this afternoon to give you a quick 4-step power love formula. And the point of this is to be able to connect to one another, to feel connected so that you open the door for other discussions.
And these 4 steps take about 4 3/4 minutes a day to do. And not only that, but they will improve the connection in your relationship if only one of you does it and the other one doesn't know you're doing it. Even if only one of you does this and the other doesn't even know you're doing it, this can still improve the connection in your relationship and make you feel closer. So let's take a look at it. Step number one.
There's another quote that says, the key to big change lies in small, everyday emotions. The idea here is to ensure that thoughts and behaviors that foster connection are a part of your daily routine. All right, so step number one, we want to get connection into our daily routine. Step number one says, fix your partner firmly in your heart during the 4 crucial times of the day. And I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit. What are the 4 crucial times? It's first of all, when you first awake in the morning. Secondly, when you leave and go your separate ways for the day, when you leave the house. Third is when you come back together in the evening or whatever time that is for you. And then fourth is when you go to sleep at night. What you want to do is come up with some kind of a connecting phrase or a connecting touch, something that will connect you to one another, and you can come up with whatever works for you. It might be a phrase, it might be something like, I still love you.
Yeah, or I'd still choose you.
Maybe you say that first thing in the morning, or maybe there's just a touch, you know, maybe you reach and just a quick hug first thing in the morning.
We're talking about sensual touch rather than sexual touch here in most cases.
Maybe it's eye contact for you. You know, you can get up in the morning and everybody's busy trying to get the kids off and get the lunches made and whatever it takes at your house. And it may not be an unhappy morning, and yet you go out the door, it's like, bye, hun, bye. And you've never even made eye contact with each other in that whole process.
Studies show that some marriages have as little as 1.5 minutes a week of eye contact.
That's terrible, isn't it? So one thing that you could do as part of your connection is just to make sure that you really look at each other and you acknowledge one another.
Uncomfortable at first, isn't it?
And there are studies done about that, too, about people that they've asked people to just lie in bed and just look at each other,
yeah,
just stare into one another's eyes for a significant period mm-hmm. of time, and the emotion just starts to flow.
They measure what's going on in the brain, and it's incredible the connection that takes place by just eye contact.
So that's one, or it could be a phrase, whatever it happens to be, and it could be a different thing at each time. But some way, during those four crucial times, when you wake, when you leave home, when you come back, and before you go to sleep, that you make sure you connect to one another.
That's step number one. Step number two, hug your partner at least 6 times a day for 6 seconds. Why 6 seconds? Because usually it takes the first 2 to 3 seconds to get over the awkwardness and to actually form a connection. But the act of hugging actually begins to produce closeness to each other. It improves the feeling of connection. The exception to this is if the relationship is degenerated all the way to the point of contempt. And then hugs are not very often welcome. But if indeed it has not gone to that point, a hug can be very healing. Now, when we talk about hugging, we're not talking about let's call them church hugs. Hugs you can get at church. Right? It'll be side by side, A-frame. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is this.
I lost count.
Were you counting? It's a long time, isn't it? And 6 times a day, wouldn't you feel connected to that person if you're doing that?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, by the way, as you hug,
yes,
they've also found something else. It increases the levels of serotonin and it decreases the appetite, so you can actually feel better and lose weight by hugging. Who knew? There you go.
Perfect. Number three. This one says to hold positive thoughts about your relationship. This is a simple one. What you want to do is take a piece of paper and you want to begin to write down the positive qualities that you find in your spouse. They're positive characteristics. It could be anything. It could be, I love that he's a great father. It could be, she's a wonderful cook. I like the way he walks. I love the way she dresses. Whatever it happens to be, many things. And if you can't come up with anything else, you know what? He takes out the garbage every Tuesday, faithfully.
There you go. I'm the best garbage man you could have married,
that's
girl.
That's right. You can find something positive. And think back. Think of the things that drew you together in the first place. Think of those positives. Write those down and carry that list with you. Sometime during your day, pull the list out and choose one of the items on the list and focus on that thing for 10 seconds. Nothing else in your mind. 10 seconds where you're thinking about this positive thing about your spouse. I might take 10 seconds to think about how much I appreciate watching Mike preach. When he preaches, that is meaningful to me. And it means a lot to me that God speaks through him and he allows God to speak through him. That's a positive for me. So I take time and I just get that picture in my mind and I think about that. And you might do it more than once during the day, but at least once during the day, you put everything else aside, you focus for 10 seconds on something good about your spouse. Keep adding to your list as you go. Carry it with you.
And what this does is it just changes your attitude towards your spouse. It changes your overall thinking and your mental picture of who that person is. It's very easy to focus on the negative, the things that person does that drives you nuts. And you know they do it. But let's turn that around and let's focus on the positive, the things that have drawn you together as well. And that becomes a very healing experience for your marriage. Step number four is to make a contract to hand out love with compassion and generosity.
Aren't those wonderful words? Compassion says, I'm going to see through that person's eyes. I'm going to have a heart of love for them. Generosity says, there's not going to be an end to my love. It's going to be generous. You know, in 1 John, the text that says, how great the love the Father has what? Lavished on them. Ah, I love that version where it says he's lavished love on us. And that's what we want to do for one another. We want to lavish love.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a contract that you make with yourself, not with your spouse. I make the contract with myself that I'm going to hand out love with compassion and generosity for my wife. And in order to do that, now I begin to ask myself some questions. If I loved her, I would. What would you do in order to show your love? And by the way, this is not what you want to do to show your love, but what your spouse would want you to do to show that love. What do they want? What would they value? What do they need? Do they desire? That's what you choose to do here. So if I loved her, if I loved him, I would, and then you fill in the blank.
And the suggestion is to make this almost like a legal contract. But remember, it's not a contract with your spouse. They may not even know about it. It's a contract with yourself. And so mine might say this: for value received, I, Gail Tucker of Dallas, Texas, assign you, Mike Tucker of Dallas, Texas, to receive from me the following from me every day. I warrant that I will say the words, I love you. I will express appreciation for a positive quality or action. You know, Mike knows that I love him, but he values those words. He values it when I say, I love you. And I know that about him, so why would I not do that? And he values it when I actually say something that I appreciate about him, when I express an appreciation for a positive quality. So that is the love contract. You make it with yourself, and you make it a decision in order to follow that every day.
So here's the power love formula. Fix your partner in your heart. Practice the 6-second hug 6 times a day. Hold positive thoughts about your spouse. And make a contract with yourself to give out love with compassion and generosity. And if you will do this, it really begins to form that connection between the two of you. It reestablishes the connection, and it strengthens the connection you already have.
All right. So we look forward to seeing you tomorrow. We're going to give you a couple of homework assignments. Number one is to start your list. All right?
Yeah.
Start your list of positive things. And number two is to be sure that you go back and take a look at the negative patterns and begin to discuss those and see what you can do in your marriage.
And practice a 6-second hug. Okay. That's always a good idea, you know? In fact, you can do that.
A 6-second hug right now.
You can do that. Come on.
All right, that's a good hug.
All right, tomorrow we'll share with you a method for conflict resolution as well as some other material, and so we look forward to seeing you then.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.